I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For as long as Kansas Cityans can remember, parts of town east of Troost have been synonymous with poverty and crime. A new ordinance called the Revive the East Side Plan is aimed at changing that. From clearing blight and illegal dumping to combating gentrification, it's a multi-tiered plan to address a complex problem. Today we hear from the council member who brought it about, that's Scott Taylor. Then we meet one of the few African-American female band directors who's hoping to use her chops on the flute to bring new excitement to the Kansas City jazz world. I'll get her to define a word we've been fascinated by, fluty nastiness. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City Councilman Scott Taylor's plan to revitalize the East Side does a lot of different things. It calls for the city to come up with $10 million for home improvements and repairs, $3 million to repair or demolish buildings deemed dangerous, a plan to combat gentrification, and develop a nonprofit community development corporation to coordinate all these efforts. It's a lot of stuff. But fellow Councilman Jermaine Reed charges that the plan gives false hope because there's no real money behind it. Now a conversation about Scott Taylor's Revive the East Side plan, which has passed the City Council. With us, City Councilman Scott Taylor, who represents the 6th District at large. He's a Kansas City mayoral candidate. Councilman, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Good to see you, Steve.
Gwen Grant is back. She's president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. Gwen, it's always great to have you here.
Thank you, Steve.
Councilman, you're from South Kansas City. Why are you so deeply invested in a plan to boost the East Side?
Well, Steve, I'm an at-large council member, and I've been on the Planning, Zoning, and Economic Development Committee for my entire time, the only council person for the last 8 years to serve on that committee. So I've seen progress and worked on projects with neighborhoods all over the city. We have a lot of progress happening in a lot of parts of the city. We've created thousands of jobs in South Kansas City, Northland, single-family homes being built, Midtown, Plaza, Westport, a lot of successes. East of Troost, we've had a lot of great individual projects, and I give credit to my colleagues in the 3rd and 5th District. They've worked hard, but we don't have that connectivity we're seeing in other parts of the city. So I thought it was time that we did something.
Parts of the city is being left out, you're saying.
Yeah, and I think it was time with a strong economy to put together a package to really give the East Side a boost.
This plan would do what? Run down the key elements for us.
So I'll tell you, it started as a job creation and economic investment package. And as we started meeting with community groups, I wanted this to be a collaborative process and really provide for community input. It took over a year to go through, do it right. We had many other things added in. Neighborhood issues came up at all these meetings we had with neighborhood groups, homes associations, great community groups like the Urban League and representatives from Urban Summit and Freedom and others. But we had to address those issues in a more holistic manner. So we included the home repair fund because you can have a great development like the shopping center at Linwood and Prospect, but we need to also make sure that the neighborhoods benefit around it.
Mm-hmm.
Gentrification was another issue that came up. On Beacon Hill, we've done some great work with new houses, single-family homes going in. But we want to make sure the surrounding neighborhoods where we've had, especially senior citizens that have been in their homes for decades, don't have their taxes rate going up so high that they get forced out of their houses.
Right. Gwen Grant with the Urban League, what do you think of Scott Taylor's plan? How does it, what do you think about it?
Well, I think it's a great plan. I have commended Councilman Taylor for the approach that he took to bring this plan forward. He was very inclusive in the design of the plan at the very nascent stage, as opposed to working in isolation of the community and then bringing forth something for the community to endorse. So
right.
We commend him for that. We also are very pleased with the content of of the ordinance and those areas of investing in housing in the urban core, providing a fund to rehab existing housing stock is very important. Addressing blight removal is very important. So there are so many aspects of this ordinance that are really outstanding for our community.
You know, I can't help but note, Gwen, and I'm curious to get your perspective on this, that, you know, these parts of town east of Truce are getting more attention today than they've gotten in years. And I'm wondering what you think about that. Suddenly, focus on the east side is where the city is right now, and it sure has been a long time in coming.
It's been a very long time coming, but it's certainly right on time. You know, it's past time that we should have been working on this, so we're really pleased to see these activities taking place. We are a long way from where we need to be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, last year we passed the 1/8 cent sales tax for Central City revitalization. We are layering on this ordinance. That's another tool. And so we're building momentum to revitalize the east side. And it's really important, especially if you understand the historical context. Mm-hmm. If you understand that we did not arrive at this place by accident, it was orchestrated and policy upon policy, you know, policies were layered on top of policies to isolate communities of color in poverty zones in Kansas City, which created this segregated city that we have. So to get out of it, we're going to have to establish policies. We're going to have to layer those policies so that we can right this ship.
You know, Councilman Taylor, this strikes me as a good opening bid from city government's standpoint. A lot of folks think you've got to have engagement from the private sector to really make this thing go. And I'm wondering, is this plan going to accomplish that? Because, again, private interests seem to be still holding back.
Yeah, I agree with you. As you know, a couple times I've been on here recently in the last few years has been for a small business microloan fund. So we can set up a small business fund east of Troost to help out entrepreneurs that have a difficult time maybe getting a traditional loan. And so the private sector is a key part of that. In this case as well, I just got an update from the city manager before we came on the air. So the reason we need to get this passed was to empower him to get out and get those private sector dollars, because I don't think this needs to all be public sector dollars. He is in discussion and has commitments on at least a few million dollars for the initial $10 million from the private sector, which is great, and that'll get things started.
And just to put this all into context, the cost of doing what you want to do, this is going to require years and years of investment. This is not going to be a magic bullet that will take a couple years and suddenly the east side will be a completely different place.
That's right, Steve, and I've been pretty realistic in talking about we need to get started with a holistic package like this as a starter to really send a message that we're serious about it. If we put as much focus east of Truce as we did downtown back in the 1990s, just imagine what the possibilities are.
You know, we had a conversation earlier this week about affordable housing, Gwen Grant, and one of the things that came out of that conversation was this factoid that stipulates that to rehab a vacant home on the east side, you think that it might not be so expensive because the shell is already there, but in fact, it costs 80% of the cost of actually building a new home.
Yes, I think, you know, there are so many challenges because of environmental issues and so many years of neglect that make urban core revitalization much more costly. And so we have to have a commitment from like this from the city to mitigate those factors, to incent developers to do housing projects, to do commercial projects in the inner city, and so that we can see the growth that we need to see there.
It means a lot of money.
It means a lot of money, but economic development means a lot of money everywhere.
Yeah.
And so we have to look at this through an equity lens. We have not been equitably investing in the urban core, and so now there's a price to pay for that neglect, and you've got to fill that gap. And it's going to take more money. It's going to take more of a commitment from the Economic Development Corporation, from the city council, from the mayor. And we hope that our next mayor will make urban core revitalization a priority. And that's something I'd like to see the new mayoral candidates talk about.
We're talking about a plan to revitalize the east side of Kansas City. My guest, City Councilman Scott Taylor, who authored this thing. Gwen Grant is president and CEO of the Urban League. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Before I go to some calls, Councilman Taylor, I just want to get you on this aspect of this issue. One of the criticisms of the plan is that, as of now, there's no real money behind it. Jermaine Reed has raised questions about it. He's a city councilman. Where is the money going to come from?
Well, Steve, as I made clear, we needed to pass the ordinance first to ask the city manager to do this, as we do with just about everything in the city. So, in an update, this has only been passed for a couple of weeks. City manager has reached out and got commitments from the private sector for a few million dollars to get started. So the money will be there, but we had to, as a council, really make a strong statement. I really want to thank my colleagues. We had a 9-3 vote in support of this.
Right. You know, one of your colleagues, Scott Wagner, has called for a property tax increase to fund affordable housing. Why not identify funding sources as part of what you're doing here?
Well, I'll tell you, I think there's so many things. About, 22 components in this. Not all of them require funding. Some of this will be new revenue, such as the small business tax credit to start a small business.
Right.
Proactive overlays and to streamline the development process, because sometimes that stops our smaller developers that want to make a difference east of Troost. So a lot of these things, the majority of these things don't require funding. For the funding items, we have the city manager working on it, and we'll have announcements very soon because we gave him a short window to report back.
I mean, is it premature to ask, would you be willing to raise taxes to do what you want to do here?
I do not believe we need to raise taxes to do what we want to do here. And that's, I've been working with the city manager on this since day one, and conceptually as far as the funding items. So I feel pretty confident we're moving forward on this pretty quickly.
Gwen Grant.
Well, you know, we're known as the city of fountains, but we probably need to change that to the city of taxes. We just want to raise, you know, have a tax to solve every problem, and it's beginning to get out of control. And so I'm very concerned about, let's talk about yet another tax.
But if you want to get serious about some of the challenges facing, I'm certainly cognizant of the passage of the 1-8 cent sales tax a year ago, which will generate $10 million a year going forward for a number of years. But again, the challenges here are so dramatic that almost anyone would say you need a lot more money to get this done.
And I think we can find the money without going to another sales tax. I think we're almost maxed out on the taxes that we can actually have in Kansas City. So I think we need to back up and really be thoughtful and pragmatic about which approach we take to get this done.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. How do you revive the east side of Kansas City? That's our topic. Let's go to some calls in. The Reverend Sam Mann from Kansas City, Missouri is calling. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning to your guests. It's good to hear y'all talking about this issue.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to call in and say, keep up the good work and keep going. And as I think Councilman Taylor knows, we are trying to encourage him to reach out to the other efforts that are taking place on the east side to create what would be similar to what the United States did to revitalize Europe, to make a Marshall Plan, to make a total plan, and to raise money not only from the public sector, but from the private sector, and to enlist a partnership with the Chamber of Commerce and the Civic Council and folks with money like that to create a plan to revive the East Side. And I just want to commend the Councilman Taylor for all the work that he's done. He called gentrification right out in the public, which nobody else seems to want to do, which we've got to deal with. I saw an editorial in the paper today about somebody saying that if you raise the tide, you raise all the boats. That's a lie.
Reverend, just that's to be real clear, you've worked on these issues for so many years. You support Scott Taylor's plan?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. We've been down there testifying with a woman and he knows about the and is in agreement, I think, if I'm all right saying this, with the notion of trying to pull together a total plan for the East Side.
Right,
that's right.
You can't just build a daycare center and say you've done a major job. You can't do that. You got to take care of the whole thing.
All right, Reverend. I appreciate the phone call. Always appreciate hearing from Sam Mann. Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it. Let's go to Cheryl from Kansas City's East Side. Cheryl, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
I'm calling to ask if your guests wouldn't mind addressing the opportunity zones. Those were just announced, and they're in specific census tracts on the East Side,
right,
with some notable exceptions, but basically on the East Side.
Councilman Taylor, explain what opportunity zones are and how that might fit in here.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and that's actually something that, as we've gone through this, we started discussing, because those just came about through the tax bill at the federal level. Congressman Cleaver's been a big champion of those, so I've had meetings with him and others. We are have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity because there's a short window on this, and basically it allows for an investment fund to be set up and invested in communities such as the zone we've created here to fund, you know, it could be housing, it could be development, but they need to find, we have to have the fund set up. Investors can be from anywhere in the United States. What they get out of it is a tax benefit,
mm-hmm,
to invest their money from a capital gains standpoint, but they can invest their money anywhere in the U.S. So we're in discussions because I think we need to be proactive. There's a timing issue on this. To get the 100% benefit under that law that passed, you've got to do it, I think, by next December to make that first investment in the fund.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Kansas City, if we are proactive, we have a lot of people meeting on it, including a lot of community groups, but also the chamber and others. If we can get our minds together pretty quickly and set something up and identify specific projects, we have the opportunity to jump in front of a lot of other communities that are going to,
right,
be doing the same thing down the line.
You know, this is so interesting to me. You know, Gwen, as Reverend Mann called in, our caller here, Cheryl, everyone's pulling different strings. Reverend Mann used this metaphor, if you will, of the Marshall Plan in the wake of World War II to repair and rebuild Western Europe. Does that apply here? Is that what you see beginning to come together?
Well, I think the important thing is that it's about galvanizing all the resources and targeting them to the area with the greatest need.
And that effort appears to be underway
right
now.
Well, it appears to be. So we're building on that. As I said earlier, you have the 1/8-cent sales tax. You've got the Taylor's revitalization plan. And so we've got the opportunity to leverage opportunity zones. So you begin to build this momentum with all of these tools. But what's missing, I think, what Reverend Mann is talking about, is that it has to have a very intentional focus, and with, mm-hmm, the area carved out, with the policies and everything directing those resources to truly revitalize a large plaque, a portion of Kansas City.
And if I understand right, Councilman Taylor, that effort, this effort aimed at a Marshall Plan, conversations are going on right now?
They are. And we, I think it's great because we have a lot of great resources. And I'll tell you, one of the reasons, I've been on the Economic Development Committee for a few years, but as chair of the committee, I thought it was time, was because of the community support for the 1/8-cent sales tax. I don't know that would have passed 5 years before, 10 years before. And so
I agree.
The community understands that the entire city needs to be going in the right direction at the same time for the entire city to continue succeeding.
You know, I don't mean to harp on this and repeat myself, but just,
sure,
this strikes me as such an interesting moment in the 35 years I've been in this community. I've never seen this kind of focus on the East Side before. I've never had conversations on this program along the lines of what we're talking about here today. It strikes me as unbelievably significant, Scott, as we sit here today.
Well, I think the community, when we work together, it's amazing what we get done. And I really want to thank all the community associations and groups and community, our leadership groups in the community that have really been helping to drive this, because,
mm-hmm,
I think everybody working together. So, yeah, I think it's significant. I think part of it is this is one of the first times we've had a strong economy in a long time.
Right.
And that gives you the ability to do a lot of these things that maybe you couldn't have done during the recession.
Well, I'd like to be even more hopeful and say that we're evolving mm-hmm. as a city and beginning to really embrace or accept or acknowledge the fact that there's this huge gap that we need to close. And so we're now looking at and getting more people to the table with that focus. And frankly, the inner city, African-American communities, Latino communities, we've always been there. So what's happening is that the majority community is starting to realize that they've got to make an investment. And so we're starting to see some movement there, which is, you know, which I think was emblematic in the passage of the 1/8 cent sales tax, mm-hmm. which was framed under one city. And so it passed in the South Corridor, you know, in huge numbers. So that was that's progress in terms of mindset
yeah.
about what needs to happen for Kansas City for us to truly be a world-class city. We've got to get this done.
And just to be clear, the two of you are saying we can proceed without further tax increases based on what you know today.
Well, I think we need to be looking at more private investments mm-hmm. rather than let's raise more taxes, because that's going to create a much more of a burden on the very people we're trying to help.
Let's go back to some calls here and go to Cher from Kansas City, Missouri. Cher, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about how to revive the east side of Kansas City. Good morning.
Good morning. I so agree with what Gwen Grant said about no more taxes. We learned that lesson this last time on the transportation tax. I don't want to vote for any more infrastructure taxes. If we pay more taxes, they should be for people. But you know what? We have this incredible heritage, our blues and jazz and barbecue, natural brand that's expected of us from everyone around the world. We can leverage that to bring incremental dollars into this area. We don't always have to go back into our pockets if we are looking at using our resources to make resources, which should also bring about new jobs for people in the inner city. And it's so important that we revitalize the east side, because it is part of our entire body, and the entire body will benefit if we can shore up that one place, that area that is detrimental to the entire body. If you have an injury to the toe, the entire body suffers.
I get it.
This is in all of our interests.
Cher, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Gwen, I wanted to get your sense of the level of support among residents east of Truce for Councilman Taylor's plan. And I should note that not everybody's on board here. I mentioned Jermaine Reed's concerns. Rachel Riley with the East 23rd Street PAC told KCUR that years of neglect have saturated her community with violence, crime, and drugs. You know that. That has left residents in poor health. She says this ordinance is one more attempt to hoodwink the East Side community. She doesn't buy it. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't really have much to say to that, other than that the way you get things done, you've got to have ordinances in place, and the community has to hold the city council and the city manager accountable.
There's a process
to the process
to
bring to make sure that these things actually take place. Certainly, what is the alternative? Do nothing? I mean, so we have to start somewhere. We chose to go for an 1/8 cent sales tax, and knowing that it only generates around $10 million a year, but $10 million is better than none. And so that bit of an investment can be used to build upon other tools. And the same holds true here.
Right.
And so we've got to be progressive in our thoughts. And certainly the urban core has been neglected for many, many years. But you're not going to pass some ordinance that's going to bring this one big fix that, you know, so this is not, we haven't been hoodwinked. I think anyone that would think that this is a non-productive approach may be the person or persons who have been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, and run amok.
Councilman Taylor, I can't help but note that the current council is going off here in the next few months. You have a big election for mayor, which you're involved in. So I'm wondering about timetables going forward. When will the city manager report back with his plan here?
Well, we have different timetables for different things, but I think very quickly, because we had some that were 30 days and 60 days, so I think we'll hear, we'll have some good news on the funding officially pretty soon. And I think the other thing I want, can I just go back to the public input on this? Because we should mention I just want to thank some of the homes associated: Blue Hills Neighborhood Association, Blue Valley Neighborhood Association, Hickman Mills United Neighborhoods, which is a lot of the South Kansas City Ruskin neighborhoods, stepped up to support and give suggestions on this. Oak Park Neighborhood, Prospect Business Association played a big part. Ruskin Heights Homes Association, Skirt Renaissance, gave a presentation. Seven Oaks, South Round Top.
We get it. Yeah, I get it. The long list.
But we also did three community, we don't usually do this with ordinances, we had three community input sessions. 139 citizens came out in favor of this.
And ultimately the council will have to sign off on any funding plan here. Do I have that right?
Well, if it's private sector, we can accept the money.
Right.
I mean, there may be some formal resolution on that, but I think that would be hard for somebody to vote no on something like that.
Right. So. But the council will have final say.
The council will have that ability on a couple of those things, but a lot of these things we've just given the authority to move forward on, such as creating the small business tax credit, and especially in the, you know, these manufacturing jobs in the Blue Valley Power Park. We have some great companies, but a lot of room for a lot of new companies to come in and invest and create jobs and hire residents east of Truce.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of City Councilman Scott Taylor from the 6th District. Gwen Grant, President and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. Happy holidays to both of you. Thanks for taking some time with us. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you,
all right.
Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about flute nastiness. You heard it here first. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. It's been a lot of jazz this week. Yesterday, the great David Bassi Trio played for us live right here in the studio. You can listen to that at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Kansas City's Northeast neighborhood saw 11 homicides in 2017. This year, they've had zero. We'll ask about the secret to their crime drop success tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Amber Underwood is one of those few African-American female band directors who also participates in the jazz scene in Kansas City. As a daughter of two educators, she was pushed to go to school, motivating her to become a teacher and not just settle for performing. With encouragement from her middle school teachers, Amber became obsessed and began taking music seriously as she entered high school. Her first instrument of choice was the sax, but at the time she was discouraged from playing it and picked up the flute by chance. After graduating college, the classically trained flute player picked up jazz and became a fashionably fun entertainer under the brand Flute Nastiness. Amber Underwood is an American jazz flutist, entrepreneur, and teacher. She works as a band leader at Central Middle School and gives private lessons in her own studio. She joins us here today. Welcome. So good to have you here.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
What's this flute nastiness thing all about? Because you got a lot of people on the radio wondering what's going on here.
I know.
You've intrigued a lot of people, I think.
I know. Well, the name kind of stumbled upon me. I was in a rehearsal.
That's how it happens usually.
I was in a rehearsal and we were working on some sonata and my accompanist at the time was having some problems in her part. And I was like, gosh, it's so nasty. And I was like, it's fluty nastiness. And I was like, ding, 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 ding. And it just kind of
stuck with
me.
That's how you sell something, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But people won't really connect the flute with something that's nasty, though.
Right.
How do you make the connection?
So fluty nastiness is kind of like an attitude. It's an attitude, a style. It's an experience. It's the way I play, very edgy. You know, I don't have that kind of elevator type sound, you know, and so that's kind of the nastiness part of me playing.
Maybe we should do is listen to a little bit now. So people get a sense of exactly what this is. This is Go Get It.
Thank you.
That's Amber Underwood. You know, not many people think about the flute in connection with jazz. Why do you?
It's in a lot of music. You hear it in Latin. You hear it as more of an auxiliary instrument.
Yes.
And I wanted to bring that instrument to the forefront and let people and have them remind them, oh, that's a flute and it has a voice.
Yes.
And I wanted to give it a voice and it could be a lead instrument.
Now, there's a very famous jazz musician in town, Claude Fiddler Williams, who passed away a number of years ago. He's a legend around here, but he made the violin an instrument that you never associated with jazz. Clearly, you want to follow in his footsteps
right,
a little
most
bit.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely. And I just feel like sometimes we're a little underrepresented in the jazz area, you know?
Is it hard to convince people that you can do it?
It was at first, but I think once they come to one of my shows and see what I'm doing, I think I convince them when they see me.
So. Is anybody else doing anything like this in jazz right now?
Yeah, I have some inspirations. There are a lot of flute players out, not necessarily here in the city, but there are a couple here in the city that we kind of band together, but... a flute player that I like to listen to is like Althea Renee or Kim Scott. You know, they're kind of in that soul, jazz, R&B, contemporary music.
And back in the day, you had Herbie Mann, right?
Yeah, Herbie Mann, Hubert Laws, yes. Frank West.
Hubert Laws comes around town once in a while.
Nestor Torres, I love. So definitely I go back and I like to emulate them, but with my own type of feel.
Yeah. I'm wondering why the flute for you? How did you wind up there?
It was really by chance, because really I wanted to play saxophone. I grew up in a house where I listened to a lot of Motown with my father.
Yeah.
And I heard that kind of band, big band type stuff. And when I had a chance, I wasn't able to play that instrument. And so I kind of just chose it because my friends were playing that instrument. And now, to this day, they all quit and I'm still playing. So,
you know, I'm noticing that you're playing at the Blue Room in the 18th and Vine District next Thursday with your group Project Live. Do you have to amplify your sound or in a room like that, will it just be you?
I do. I do amplify my sound. I feel like part of me is my sound, you know, and what I can do. And I do a little different things with my pedal. You know, to get that kind of, you know, altered sound.
Yes.
But I definitely have to amplify my sound. I hate to be attached to a cord or a one-directional mic. I like to be able to move across the stage.
What's Project Live? Tell us about your group.
So it's Amber Underwood Project, and I say live because I'm all about getting the live experience when you come to the show. We've been around for about 4 years. And it's basically an experience that you get. You get an entire show, entertainment, intro, you get a little bit of dancing. I might do a costume change in the middle. Growing up, I kind of wanted to be the female prince. I wanted to be an all-around entertainer, you know, and I wanted to not just have a typical jazz show. I wanted, you're getting jazz, you're getting contemporary, you're getting good quality music, but you're also getting a full entertainment show, something that you would see like at the Sprint Center or something like that.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You know, your credentials are amazing. A bachelor's and two master's degrees.
Yeah.
Most musicians don't normally, you know, complete as much school as you clearly have. Why all the degrees?
Well, I come from a background of educators, so
right.
It was not, are you going to school, is which school are you going to? And so my dad always told me, you know, get as much education as you can, because no one else can tell you, they can't take that away from you. So if I was going into music, you know, a lot of eyebrows raised because they're like, so what are you going to do with that? You know? And so I went into performance and then I, you know, went into education. I have a master's in arts and music business and arts administration. I wanted to cover all areas in my field. And so if I wanted to do that, I can say, you know what, I have a degree in that. I can do that.
You know, one of your schools was Pittsburgh State University. Were you able to learn anything specifically when it comes to your music down there?
Well, actually, I took my classes here in the area, in the Kansas City area, in that campus. And so that was more toward education, learning further in higher education and things like that. So really not necessarily in music, but it was definitely, since that was in my area, it was more educational based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much do you practice every day?
Oh, I wish I had so much more time to practice. Why you ask me that?
Do you hate it?
No, I actually want more. Mm-hmm. I feel like I don't get the practice that I need. I tend to pick up my practice time during the summer since I am a full-time, you know, band director. So I practice whenever I can.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult. I have mm-hmm. to manage my time very carefully. And I sometimes get jealous of my musician counterparts that don't maybe have a 9-to-5 or something. And I wish I had that time to be able to create, but I just have to work it into my schedule.
You know, you just mentioned, Amber, that you're a female band director. Is that so unusual that I shouldn't even be asking you about it or not?
I mean, it is a little unusual. I'm starting to see a little bit more, but, you know, coming up, it was kind of the good old boys club. It's more of a male-dominated field. we have more females in there, but I'm kind of in a group. I kind of know most of the band directors in the area. And mm-hmm. so, and I've played in the North Winds Symphony that's kind of made up of music educators and band directors. And so, you know, it's just, we're just a little underrepresented. You know, and especially being an African-American female, too, you don't see that much. You might see it on the choir side of the orchestra, but I'm specifically talking about band.
Why is that? Because you wouldn't think of music as that's a fairly universal kind
of
idea and everyone does it. And why would that be a male-dominated area?
You know, I can't really answer that question. You
In
know,
fact, jazz is male-dominated.
It really, really is.
You think
is.
Of the great players of the 1950s, you don't think of a lot of women.
It really, really is. And I guess that's why I'm so unique, because I feel like I need to show that. And when people ask me, oh, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I'm a band director. And I kind of get like, oh, really? Like an eye raise, because I guess they, you know, didn't really expect that from me. Even in college, I was always asked, are you a dance major? I was like, no, but thank you for saying. Or they thought I was a vocal major. I was like, no, I'm a horn player and I'm in music education. I'm going to be a band director. And so, I don't know, it just kind of gave an eye raise, but, you know, it's all good. And I don't see very many female instrumentalists out here. You know, I can kind of name a few on my fingers, but it needs to change, because we see a lot of those females in secondary school. They might go off to college, but kind of on the level where we're performing, it's very difficult. And I don't know why. I don't know where the disconnect is. When I was doing jam sessions and things like that, you know, they thought I was a singer. And I was like, no, I'm here to jam and try to play with you guys. You know,
there are lots of things I don't understand, but this lack of women in what you do, that would certainly be one of them. I'm not sure I understand that.
Yeah. You know, I don't either, Steve. I wished we had more representation. You know, I look at my male counterparts, and I do feel like I need to be able to be on their level and be able to play at their level. I kind of was in a point where I felt like I had to play like that, you know, and I came out of it and I was like, you know, I need to do my own thing. I was like, this is me. I don't need to, you know, be like him or him over there playing these instruments.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's Amber Underwood. Again, she performs at 7 o'clock next Thursday. That's a week from tonight at the Blue Room in the 18th and Vine District. Is this going to be your Kansas City coming out on the jazz scene, or have you been?
Well, no, I've actually been out for a while.
Yeah.
You know, I started about 4 years ago. And so I've been just kind of on the come up a little bit, but now I've been kind of a staple, like at the Black Dolphin. I play there about once a month.
Which is a great place to play.
Yeah, I love it there. I play at a lot of different restaurants and private events, but actually, to tell you the truth, the Blue Room will be my kind of debut under my name.
That's what I was thinking.
Under my name, yes. And so I'm really happy, because I've played there many of times with other people or have been featured, but to actually be at the Blue Room under Amber Underwood Live.
It's a project. Big night.
It's going to be a big night. So you got to come out. You got to experience fluty nastiness.
Good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You bet. That's Amber Underwood. Yesterday in the program, I met a group of students from East High School who organized a mayoral debate. Hear about their event and learn about the issues they hold dear. You'll find it at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Johnson County librarians recommend their picks for children's literature, from picture books to chapters, exploring the book kids should be reading this holiday season. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.